Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Sunday, August 23rd, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Cosette. Good morning.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning to everyone. Economic Stalwart Faces Uncertain Times by D.T. Coley at Globe Staff. Before Douglas Cowell took a job at Boston University, he spent his days as a casting director for movies, making a living one gig at a time. Working at a college, by contrast, seemed predictable. Classes start in September and end in May. Students apply, arrive, and eventually graduate, most of them at least. The staff and faculty are the ones who stick around for years or even decades. I was looking for something consistent, said Cowell, 44, something that would allow me to be present for my family. He took a job as a media technician at BU in 2023. The pay was enough to make do and support his two kids in an expensive city. And as someone who grew up in a family of teachers, Cowell felt called to a student-centric job. Then, in June, after 3 years, BU laid him off. The university said it eliminated his position as part of a broad campaign to cut costs. The stability, Cowell said, was an illusion. This realization, that job security in higher education is not what it used to be, is bubbling up at universities across New England. Amid growing financial pressures, schools have transformed what were once career jobs into de facto temporary positions they can cycle in and out as the budget demands. That takes a toll on the 128,000 people who work at Massachusetts universities, a number nearly as large as the local biotech industry, and on the broader economy. Higher education employment accounts for a larger share of total wages in the Commonwealth than in any state but Rhode Island, federal data show. But after 3 years in the 3% range, job growth in the sector slowed to 0.5% in 2025. Layoffs, once rare, are becoming more common, with at least 400 university jobs cut over 6 months last year. After two college closures this spring, another 350 or so university employees lost their jobs. Many other vacant staff and professorship positions have been eliminated. The future of the sector looks increasingly bleak. College attendance reached record highs this year, but the decline in birth rate since the 2008 recession is starting to hit the application pool and forcing schools to compete for students. The demographic cliff, a 13% decline in high school graduates by 2041, has finally begun, just as the Trump administration transforms both federal research funding and student loans, two long reliable streams of revenue for universities. Schools are scaling back graduate programs and shuttering whole departments. Over the next decade, hundreds of colleges across the country are at risk of closing entirely. Confidence in higher education is declining generally, too, as a growing share of students pursue vocational degrees or skip college altogether. It's all chipping at the bedrock of the Massachusetts middle class, along built and nurtured in no small part by the substantial academic industry. Already in classrooms and laboratories, universities are keeping fewer full-time and tenured professors on the payroll. But when cuts begin, non-teaching jobs, catering directors, research scientists, and librarians are often the first to go. It's the working man's sector of higher ed. Bearing the brunt, said Zachary Boss, a former BU departmental administrator and staff union president. If you are not a member of the professional or managerial administrative ranks at a college, you're on the chopping blocks first. Boston University, for example, terminated 120 staff positions in July 2025, then followed that with a series of layoffs that included Cowell. Even Harvard, with its $57 billion endowment, recently began laying off staff at its Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Some are trying to keep a long-term perspective. Universities have survived existential attacks for generations, and the threats that rained down from the White House in 2025 are only the latest iteration, said Joshua Goodman, a higher ed economist at Boston University. Most schools have now baked the worst of the scenarios into their budgets, Goodman added, which could be a positive sign for the future. But college workers can no longer depend on having a steady, reliable job with excellent benefits in the way they once did. For decades, university jobs in student services, campus faculties, or academic administration provided good pay and benefits, enough to buy a house, build a life, save for retirement. When Cowell started at BU, for example, he appreciated the school's generous paternity leave and a huge incentive schools often offer to employees, tuition remission. It represented a promise that when Cowell's kids were old enough, they could potentially go to BU for a fraction of the all-in-attendance price. Today, BU's full sticker price tops $98,000 a year. But even before Cowell lost his job, he realized it couldn't last. "I went from being happy to be home for dinner every night to seeing all the cracks," he said. "It started to restructure from how great this place is to wondering, is this really right for me?" Other college staff have come around to the same sentiment, said Boss, the BU union representative. "They're burnt out, overworked, covering for colleagues who were not replaced or bogged down by a lack of upward mobility. In worst case scenarios, when schools such as Hampshire College close, their faculty and staff may be left to fend for themselves without severance to cushion the landings." Boss knows a former university lecturer who opened a farm west of Worcester, a philosophy professor who became a home organization consultant, and a literature faculty member who found a job as a researcher for an advocacy group. Take Emma Pitt, 28. She had worked at BU for almost 4 years after she finished her graduate degree from the College of Communication. The job allowed her to produce videos and teach her technical skills to students, and she misses the implicit promises, routine, and reliability that came with it. "You will not get paid a ton, but you will get paid enough to live on," Pitt recalled being told. "Promotions and raises will come rarely, but the benefits, health insurance and time off, are really good." She was later laid off due to financial reasons, Pitt said. In March, she started working as an in-costume guide on the Freedom Trail. "Some university employees are now desperate to hold on to a campus career," said Laura DeVio, a visiting professor of higher education at Boston College. She was heartened to have 30 students in her 2025 graduate cohort, but worried about the university job market ahead of them. "By December, all but one were in a job," she said, though it was not easy. "Employees older than 45 are overrepresented in the administrative ranks of college campuses," DeVoe said. "And when they leave or retire, the institution often says, we're not going to fill that job." And the top market is particularly tough on older workers, including Mary Dockray Miller, an English professor at Lesley University in Cambridge for over 25 years. She was laid off with about two dozen other faculty in 2023. Dockray Miller applied for a dozen jobs. Not one got back to her for an interview. "If I was looking for an assistant professor to teach a humanities survey at Boston University, I wouldn't hire me either," she said. "I would hire a 35-year-old recent PhD with a good chunk of time ahead of her." Still, Dockray Miller feels lucky. She can manage, since she already knows her house. She has decided she will not move away from her family and spends her free time teaching American Sign Language at local libraries. Even in the 1990s, when Dockray Miller first became a professor, the job market for humanities professors was abysmal, she said. But back then, every little college in Massachusetts was their own economic powerhouse, employing hundreds of people to do all sorts of things. "Now, I see very bleak prospects for the person over 50 who has been the athletics facilities manager at a small college in western Massachusetts," she said. "That person is not going to be able to get another job, and the faculty at that college are probably not going to be able to get other jobs." Bill Battelle, 61, experienced just that. After Worcester Polytechnic Institute cut his longtime position as an event planner last year, Battelle interviewed at four other schools around Massachusetts. Two shortlisted him for the job, but later passed. Staying in higher education, Battelle realized, would require a longer job search and likely a pay cut. So he became a project manager for an aerospace company instead. Now he has to split time between Massachusetts and Florida, but earns far more money. Patel had long planned to retire at WPI, but now believes that colleges are not able to retain experienced staff because they cannot or will not put the time, effort, and resources there. Cowell, the former BU employee, can still envision a best-case scenario in higher ed. It all depends on who will hire him, or if they will. He was terminated during his paternity leave and is still searching for a job. The university later listed a media technician position similar to his former one. Cowell applied, but never heard back. "I want to keep doing it if I can," Cowell said, "but it feels like there are no guarantees." Clancy Case Shows Gaps in Patient Oversight by Sarah Rahel at Globe Staff. When a patient screens positive for postpartum depression in Massachusetts, the law provides a course of action for clinicians: discuss treatment, prescribe medication, and refer the patient to a mental health expert. Then what? What happens once a patient is referred to the mental health system as taken on new urgency during the trial of Lindsay Clancy, the Duxbury mother who killed her three young children in January 2023? Her defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, has argued the mental health system failed Clancy, that she put her postpartum struggles in the hands of a half dozen specialists, but they failed to coordinate with each other while showering her with some 30 prescriptions over 4 months. During her testimony, Reddington repeatedly asked the clinicians why they did not follow up with each other or even seek access to Clancy's full medical records as she entered hospitals or sought other psychiatric treatment. The testimony underscored what some experts said is a clear failing within the medical system. "I wish I could say there was one person responsible for coordinating that kind of care. Right now, that doesn't exist within our system," said Dr. Nancy Byatt, a perinatal psychiatrist and professor at UMass Chan Medical School in Worcester. "We've heard from perinatal and postpartum individuals who feel like they need someone to help broker all these relationships. It takes a village." The problem isn't limited to behavioral health, experts say. "The reality is, these gaps exist in the entire health system," said Dr. Jennifer Payne, professor of psychiatry neurobehavioral sciences and vice chair of research at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. "Anybody who's prescribing a medication should follow up with that patient," Payne said. "But patients can seek care elsewhere," she added, "and nobody's tracking that." In Franklin, Martha Jean, MJ, Govea, is a conduit for various providers for her son, Sam, 13, who has ADHD, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, and depression. "Those providers all talk separately to the health insurance company," she said, "and she's left to pick up the pieces." She estimates she spends at least 15 hours a week managing his care. She keeps track of diagnoses, monitors medications and refills, and handles prior authorizations. She chases referrals, decides which records should go to which providers, and checks clinical notes for accuracy. "I'm not the only parent who does this," Gouveia said. "The system is built to fail people." Under a 2024 law addressing maternal health issues, primary care providers, obstetricians, gynecologists, midwives, and pediatricians in Massachusetts must offer patient screening for postpartum depression. If the results indicate the patient is experiencing such depression or another major depressive disorder, the clinician must discuss treatment and refer the patient to a mental health expert. The statute does not spell out who owns the patient's care after that handoff. That distinction matters because mental illness, unlike diabetes or high blood pressure, does not present in a predictable way. Postpartum psychosis is a fluctuating condition, and diagnoses are not always a snapshot, said Dr. Susan Song, a Harvard and Stanford-trained psychiatrist based in Washington, D.C. In psychiatry, she said, a diagnosis can be a working formulation that changes as a clinician sees a patient over time. That's not a bad thing, she said, but those providers may be seeing only pieces. It's all the blind men touching different parts of the elephant, Song said. A psychiatrist managing medication may hear one story, and the therapist will hear another. What we need is a medical home, she said. It's actually a good thing that people see different providers in consultations, but you need some home, such as a single provider or guardian, to manage or make sense of it all. In an ideal system, Song said, a clinician or team would be explicitly responsible for coordinating care. Until then, families should ask who is overseeing communication among providers, receiving records, and tracking medication changes. If no clinician can take that on, then unfortunately a family member may need to hold the pieces together. Obtaining records for mental health treatment adds additional complications. Federal privacy law generally treats mental health information like other medical records, but notes from psychotherapy receive additional protection and generally require patient authorization before they can be shared with another provider. I can refer a patient to a specialist, and I never hear back from them again, or patients are referred to me, but they don't have any medical history whatsoever, said Song. I'll ask for medical records from past providers, but mental health is treated very differently in medical documentation, and records vary on the system the practitioner is using. Still, providers should request records, and patients have the choice whether to provide or decline access, she said. The Clancy trial has demonstrated how difficult that can become. Defense attorney Kevin Reddington questioned Rebecca Giolotta, one of Nate Clancy's providers, about what happened after Clancy voluntarily entered McLean Hospital in early January 2023, weeks before the killings. Giolotta testified that she did not have access to Clancy McLean's records. Reddington asked whether anyone had asked Clancy to sign a release allowing her providers to obtain those records. I did not, Giolotta replied. In pressing murder charges against Clancy, prosecutors argue she closely managed her own treatment and did not always take medications as prescribed. Clancy, meanwhile, has admitted to killing her children, but asserts she should not be held criminally responsible because she was in the throes of postpartum psychosis. In sorting responsibility for a patient's care, technology can bridge some divides. Shared electronic record systems can allow clinicians to see records from other institutions. But if the patient sees a provider who doesn't use a shared system, some mental health providers in private practice do not use the electronic medical record system, EPIC. It won't appear in the patient's file. It is very difficult to get psychiatry medical records anywhere in this country, Payne said. And tracking them down takes time and resources that are not reimbursed by insurance. There are no requirements, Payne said, or follow-up. It's very much left to the individual practice and practitioner. There are legitimate reasons mental health information is handled carefully. For example, Gouveia, the Franklin woman whose son has multiple clinicians, is selective about sharing his complete medical record with every one of them. In some cases, it's because she wants a new clinician to assess him with fresh eyes. But absent Gouveia's intense involvement, it's not clear who else would bear the burden of reconciling all his competing needs, a psychiatrist, primary care doctor, case manager. Nobody talks, she said. I give the info and they run with it. After the birth of her first son, Gouveia said, she struggled with postpartum depression and was later diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She had the same counselor for 18 years, but multiple psychiatric providers. But for her three sons, she said, navigating their mental health care has been far harder. From a provider standpoint, Payne said, most practices will have a nurse or somebody who will try to track down people who are supposed to be following up or supposed to be filling their medication, but people fall through the cracks. Clancy's treatment history was unusually extensive. To Gouveia, the number of different medications Clancy was prescribed was difficult to comprehend, she said. In her experience, pharmacists are often the only checkpoint. They break everything down for the patient and talk to the provider, insurance companies, or question if treatment is going to work, she said. When it comes to coordinating care solutions, there's no easy fix, Song said. Because the American health care system is so fragmented and it's hard for patients to get care, she said, it's completely appropriate to refer out. But someone has to be the guardian and oversee all of it. And that's more than likely up to the patient. Next up, Dumpster Fire by Paul Heintz at Globe Staff. Dateline Stowe, Vermont. When he first heard the noise, Luis May thought there was a burglar in the house. Realizing that was unlikely at 6:30 a.m. in June in this rural resort town, he closed his eyes and tried to go back to sleep. A few minutes later, he opened them again. "I look to my left, and there's this bear less than 8 feet away," said May, a 75-year-old gastroenterologist from New York City. "He's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and I scream, 'Holy expletive!'" May's wife, Suzanne Zermer, sat up in bed, called 911, grabbed her bathrobe, and bolted out of the house, leaving May fumbling around for clothing. "He yelled, 'Why didn't you wait for me?'" she recalled. "I said, 'Every man for himself, pal.'" By the time Tuscarora Police Department SUV showed up, the juvenile bear was gone. Yogi, as May calls him, had climbed back out the window through which he'd entered. He hasn't been seen since. Such encounters are increasingly common in Vermont, where the black bear population has surged over the past 8 years, according to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. In 2025, the last year for which figures are available, an estimated 7,500 to 8,900 of the creatures roamed Vermont. Roughly doubled the target population the department has set for the state. That's led to a corresponding rise in human-bear interactions, including home invasions and vehicle entries. Prior to 2018, the department rarely logged more than 200 incidents a year. Nowadays, there are typically more than 1,400. And this year, early indications suggest the state could reach or exceed its annual record of 1,700. Nowhere is the problem worse than in Vermont's ski towns, where prime bear habitat overlaps with a glut of vacation homes, restaurants, and overflowing dumpsters. "The bears have figured it out," said Jacqueline Comeau, a wildlife biologist and the Black Bear Project leader for the department. "It just seems to be a consistent recipe for high numbers of human-bear conflicts." In recent summers, Comeau said, "Killington and Stowe have been neck and neck for the title of who's struggling the most to live with bears. This year, it's Stowe. Since June 1st, state game wardens have responded to at least 40 bear incidents in Stowe, which is nestled between two mountain ranges and surrounded by state forest." "We're down here almost daily," said Lieutenant Robert Currier, who oversees wardens in the region, which takes us away from other parts of our mission. It's also created divisions in town and circular blame game. Some fault business owners for failing to secure their dumpsters. Others cite short-term rental guests for leaving trash outside. Many say the town should do more to address the problem. Business owners say they feel targeted by activists. And seemingly everybody gets mad when law enforcement kills a problem bear. "We're kind of at a fever pitch here in Stowe," said Brenna Galzeni, who lives in town and leads the statewide advocacy group Protect Our Wildlife. Earlier this month, Currier drove his truck around the back roads of Stowe, not far from where Yogi entered Louis May's bedroom. The area is speckled with multi-million dollar homes featuring views of Stowe, Vermont, of Stowe Mountain Resort, most owned by trusts and LLCs, and many available for seasonal or short-term rental. "We're surrounded by bear habitat right now," he said, pointing to the densely forested landscape. "There's not a lot of human traffic up and down through the day." At the height of deforestation in Vermont, during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, bears retreated to areas like this, according to Comeau. As the forest grew back, so did the population of bears. "It's this huge conservation success story," she said. "But now that there's a critical mass of reproductively active female bears, with a diverse food supply ranging from beech nuts to acorns to berries to corn, it's been difficult to get the population under control." Last year, hunters killed a near-record 1,022 bears in Vermont, according to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Another 116 were fatally struck by vehicles, and 45 more were killed during a human-bear conflict, either by law enforcement or a member of the public. Still, the population continues to grow. Some have learned to swipe bird feeders, raid chicken coops, and open car doors, behaviors a mama bear can pass on to her cubs during their long adolescence. "We've really been teaching our bears for years now about all the foods they can get in our backyards and in our town centers," Comeau said. Black bears are generally uninterested in humans and rarely hurt them. But over the last 8 years, as the population has grown, the department has tracked 6 injuries to people, most resulting from a surprised bear seeking to evade a dog or human. It could get worse. In a near miss this June close to Sugarbush Resort, a bear climbed on the roof of a truck and tried to reach through its partially opened window to steal chicken nuggets from a 10-month-old girl inside, according to records obtained by the Globe. The girl's father, who was working on a pool nearby, tried to scare off the bear with his colleagues. He grabbed a 9mm handgun from the cab of the truck and fired a warning shot. When the bear still wouldn't budge, he fired twice more and the bear limped away, leaving a trail of blood in its wake. The child was uninjured, but in extreme distress, according to a warden report, and her car seat and stuffed toys were damaged. In Stowe, the incident that changed everything came in early June, when a bear broke into the kitchen of the Matterhorn Bar and Restaurant, an après ski joint just downhill from Stowe Mountain Resort. When Stowe Police Corporal Jamie Bunakvix arrived on the scene, the 200 to 300-pound bear was laying down near the dumpsters, consuming an entire jug of sauce from the walk-in cooler, according to a police report. Officers had encountered a similar situation there a week earlier. A state game warden instructed Bunakvix to shoot the bear if it had entered the restaurant again. The bear then proceeded to enter the walk-in cooler and start rummaging through the frozen chicken patties, Bunakvix wrote in the report, prompting him to fatally shoot the bear as it exited the establishment. The episode provoked outrage in the community, according to Police Chief Brooke Osteen. She was inundated with phone calls, emails, and social media posts from those faulting Bunakvix for pulling the trigger, even though he'd done so at the direction of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. One person showed up at the police station and said they wanted to string the officer up, Osteen said. Others blamed the Matterhorn, which had a reputation for tolerating bear visits and threatened to boycott. The bar's owner, Charlie Schaefer, declined to speak with the Globe, but had previously told 7 Days newspaper he was horrified by the situation. If I had been there, I would have put myself between the bear and them, he said of the cops. It's ridiculous. I know why they did it. I don't know why they did it. Excuse me. The incident prompted Osteen to rethink her department's approach to your sign interactions. Previously, her officers would respond to most bear sightings in town and try to shoo the creatures away. Now she asks herself, did the bear commit a crime or not? Town manager Charles Shafford said he's not surprised Stowe has become ground zero for bears in Vermont, given that it's home to 40 restaurants, 1,000 hotel rooms, and another 1,000 short-term rental units. We're a mountain town, he said. We have a lot of food. Last year, the select board updated its ordinances to require homes and businesses to keep garbage contained in dumpsters and to quickly pick up any messes. Those who failed to comply would be fined. Galdenzi of Protect Our Wildlife thinks the town hasn't gone far enough. She believes it should require businesses to use bear-proof dumpsters and perhaps help subsidize them. I think voluntary compliance isn't getting us where we need to be, she said. Galdenzi has also tried public pressure. Another group she co-founded, the Stowe Bear Project, has been posting on social media and writing on a town listserv when its members have observed overflowing dumpsters behind local businesses. I don't think Stowe wants to be known for as a town that kills a lot of bears, she said. And that's what our reputation is turning into. If a lot of tourists found out, I don't think it would be well received. Such tactics infuriate Mike Bunano, the second-generation owner of Stowe Cinema. They've never actually come and spoken to me directly, but they feel free to write about me online, which feels very high school, he said. He's also peeved at the police, who have issued him and his business 2 tickets this summer for violating the updated ordinance, totaling $300 in fines. He said he's planning to take the town to court. Bunano's family has owned the local movie theater since 1972, but he'd never seen a bear until 2 years ago. Now, a mama bear and her 3 yearlings visit the dumpster out back nearly every day. It doesn't matter how much reinforcing you do of the dumpsters. They figure out how to rip the lid right off, he said. The town's answer is to write citations. Mateo Fernandez, 18, sells tickets at the theater, makes popcorn, and takes out the trash. He's run into a bear out back half a dozen times this summer. "We'll sometimes have to, like, throw a rock to try to scare it away," he said. "But it'll just kind of look at us and then go back to it. Doesn't care at all." Unano said he's considered buying a bear-proof dumpster, but they're expensive and difficult to operate. He thinks the town should help pay for them and tamp down the rhetoric. "Stowe is a great community. We want to stay a community," he said. "We don't want to be divided by negativity around bears." The Department of Fish and Wildlife has been trying to educate Vermonters about the steps they can take to reduce bear encounters, including taking down bird feeders in the spring, securing chickens with electric fencing, and keeping garbage enclosed. But it can be difficult to reach short-term renters and other tourists. The department has also proposed two changes to its bear hunting rules to curb the population, lengthening the season by several weeks and allowing hunters to take two bears a year in some parts of the state, rather than just one. Protect Our Wildlife opposes both proposals. "We cannot hunt our way out of the problem," Galdenzi said. But Chris Bradley, president of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs, thinks a larger bear harvest could be part of the solution. "Effective management is not always pretty," he said, "yet it is part of our landscape and it's part of our heritage and tradition." As for Luis May and Suzanne Zermer, they're taking their recent encounter with Yogi in stride. "I mean, what are you going to do? You live in Boston or New York or Chicago, you're going to have rats," Zermer said. "You live in a rural area, you're going to get rural issues." "They're bears," said May. "They were here before us, weren't they?" "I think they were." Healthcare Debate is More Than Semantics, by Samantha J. Gross at Globe Staff. U.S. Senator Ed Markey has repeatedly touted his support for Medicare for All, and his endorsement from his champion, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, saying his backing of a national single-payer system bolsters his progressive credentials. His Democratic primary opponent, U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, says he too believes the country needs to rethink the cost of health care, but that it should instead embrace universal health care. You may be thinking, what's the difference? Moulton's pitch would cover the uninsured, but also allow for people to buy their own private insurance or enroll in an employer-sponsored plan. Markey's ideal Medicare for All would eliminate private insurance in place of a single-payer system. But to hear it all differently, the two Democrats also are speaking from a somewhat similar script. Healthcare, as currently constructed, isn't working. Premiums are rising, federal subsidies have been slashed, and it's become increasingly difficult to access care. The Democratic hopefuls and political watchers and policy experts, too, will say there's actually quite a bit of daylight between them, that Markey and Moulton aren't leaning into these pitches ahead of the September 1st primary speaks to the rising costs that are unsettling residents and businesses, and the candidates' own attempts to assuage voters. It also underscores their mission to prove to Democratic primary voters which man truly has the liberal bona fides, as well as their desire to stand out in a race where both candidates often land on the same side of national issues. The U.S. healthcare system is a hybrid of private insurance, whether sponsored by employers or bought directly by consumers, and public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. While the Affordable Care Act expanded insurance coverage, the United States remains one of the few developed nations without a fully universal healthcare system. Massachusetts has led in this area, reforming healthcare in 2006 and establishing a marketplace, the Massachusetts Health Connector, for those eligible for free and lower-cost care. The term Medicare for All is regularly repackaged to fit a politician's platform. Still, it often refers to legislation long championed by progressives that would establish a universal, single-payer national health insurance system, similar to those in Canada, the United Kingdom, or Taiwan, and eliminate private insurance. The version pushed by Sanders would, however, go further than any other country, experts say, in also covering dental, vision, and other costs. During a debate earlier this month, Markey affirmed that his support for Medicare for All makes him a clear choice as a progressive candidate. He was going to fight for the future of Massachusetts families. The term Medicare for All was mentioned 12 times during the hour-long event. Markey accounted for 11 of the mentions. In doing so, he also boasted endorsements from a cadre of progressive leaders, such as Representative Ayanna Pressley, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Ann Sanders, the Vermont Independent who has refiled the Medicare for All Act in the Senate every year since 2017. Warren made the idea a tentpole of her 2020 presidential campaign. Sanders, of course, did too. It's about Medicare for All, which Congressman Moulton does not support, Markey said during an August 3rd debate, accusing Moulton of opting to side with the big healthcare companies. In their third and final debate on Thursday, Moulton said addressing affordability means healthcare for all, which is something the senator and I agree on. Markey shot back, "Well, first of all, we know I support Medicare for all, and Congressman Moulton does not." Moulton has most times made a universal healthcare pitch that veers closer to then-President Barack Obama's Medicare for All Who Want It approach, which Congress never passed. Universal healthcare, as Moulton has framed it, would offer public health insurance to those who want it while also keeping private healthcare plans available. Moulton, a Marine veteran who receives healthcare through the Department of Veterans Affairs, said having competition among health plans brings down costs, an argument that has been studied without a definitive conclusion. He also knocked the potential costs of instituting a single-payer system, which could run in the trillions. Medicare should be available to all. Markey thinks it should be imposed on all, he said. We don't need taxes to go up because of the senator's plan. At an unrelated event in Boston on Wednesday, Moulton needled Markey, saying he promised Medicare for all when he was last elected in 2020. We need an approach that would actually work, Moulton said. If you have a healthcare plan that you really like, you shouldn't be forced off of that program. In a recent poll of likely 2026 midterm voters by healthcare research nonprofit KFF, 60% of Democratic voters said it is extremely important that candidates talk about healthcare costs. Nearly 6 in 10 said they were worried about affording health insurance or out-of-pocket costs for medical visits and prescription drugs. Ashley Kurtzinger, director of survey methodology at KFF, said the split between those who support transitioning to single-payer healthcare, a la Medicare for all, and those who want to reform the existing Affordable Care Act falls between more progressive and more moderate wings. She added, however, that many people don't fully understand the complex structures of different health insurance systems. Messaging can have a lot of impact on public opinion, she said. Plus, Massachusetts has already expanded healthcare coverage, and a far higher share of its population under 65 is insured, nearly 98%, than in the rest of the country. 10% nationwide reported being uninsured in a federal survey. That means voters here may care more about healthcare costs rather than access, Kurtzinger said. To that end, some voters in well-insured Massachusetts may feel like Medicare for All is a solution to other states' problems, said Lee Moore Duffney, an economist and public policy professor at Harvard University Business School and the John F. Kennedy School of Government. The bigger concern for voters in our state is affordability. And are we going to do something about that? Said Daphne, who oversaw healthcare at the Federal Trade Commission and advised the Congressional Budget Office for over a decade. If people are voting with their local hats in mind, they are more concerned about how expensive it is to have the healthcare we have in Massachusetts. Mark Peterson, a political science professor at UCLA and senior fellow at the university's Center for Health Policy Research, said in his experience polling voters, very few people like the current version of healthcare in the United States. He said the idea of expanding health insurance has come up in campaigns more than I've ever seen before. There's a basis for politicians to come forward and say, we know this is what the public wants, Peterson said. What we don't agree on is how exactly to do it. Next up, U.S.-Canada fall deeper into trade war. by Paul Weissman and Rob Gillies at the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. The United States and Canada, historic allies along an undefended border, fell deeper into a trade war Saturday, marked by angry recriminations and new tariffs that are expected to raise prices for products in both countries. Each side blamed the other for the collapse of negotiations in Washington late Friday, leading the U.S. to impose 50% tariffs on $20 billion worth of Canadian goods, and Canada setting September 8th as the start of its retaliatory penalties. President Trump's import taxes will hit about 5% of what Canada ships to the United States every year, ranging from hockey sticks to tongue depressors. Prime Minister Mark Carney said Ottawa would respond with targeted tariff protection for industries exposed to the new U.S. duties, including some steel products. He also mentioned the dairy, appliance, agricultural equipment, pulp and paper, and electronics sectors. No further talks were planned. Whatever the eventual outcome, a loss of trust seems one of the earliest casualties. Carney accused Washington of using economic integration as a weapon and said its signature was written in pencil. Resorting to the language of the battle, he said his country had been attacked by the new American tariffs. "You're at war when you get attacked," he said, adding that Canada had the reserves, resilience, and plan to respond. But to Trump's chief trade negotiator, Jamison Greer, the United States was compelled to act after a year of retaliation by its longtime partner. "We've said enough, and so we've taken countermeasures. Our interest is in protecting American workers and protecting American supply chains," the U.S. trade representative told Fox and Friends Weekend. Carney said Canada had been willing to drop remaining retaliatory tariffs on steel, aluminum, and autos if the U.S. sustainably lowered its own, and to encourage provinces to restore U.S. alcohol sales. But he said Washington's final demands went too far. "They asked too much and offered too little," Carney said. Greer and the Republican administration was offering to cut tariffs on steel, autos, and lumber, things that are sensitive for them. And they've always had the best deal, and they still would have an even better deal. But they didn't want that. As a result, he said, "We're moving forward with measures that respond to Canadian retaliation." Carney said the U.S. added a last-minute terms that would have reduced tariff relief for Canadian-made vehicles, restricted Canada's ability to strike trade deals with other countries, and weakened protections for language, culture, and sovereignty. He said such demands were unacceptable. The breakdown in negotiations marked a sharp reversal from 2 days earlier, when officials from the two countries sounded as if they were headed towards a compromise. Ontario Premier Doug Ford, who leads Canada's most populous province, praised Carney for rejecting the deal, saying it would have hurt Ontario's auto, steel, and manufacturing sectors. Ford urged Canada to use every tool in our toolbox to fight the U.S. tariffs. The moves also call into question the future of a North American trade agreement covering the United States, Canada, and Mexico that is crucial to industry in all three countries. Carney and the breakdown was certainly not good news for the review of that agreement, and that the failed negotiations had given Canada a new perspective on what Washington wants from the broader economic relationship. The political impact will likely be even bigger than the economic fallout. The countries sold each other $880 billion worth of goods and services last year. The tariffs were initially supposed to kick off at 12:01 a.m. Wednesday. Trump extended the deadline for 3 days to allow talks to continue, but the countries would not reach an agreement in time. The U.S. and Canada have wrangled for decades over trade, poking each other over sore spots such as Canadian softwood lumber imports and U.S. access to Canada's protected dairy market. Somehow they still managed to remain friends, allies, and trading partners. Canadian soldiers fought alongside Americans in Afghanistan after 9/11. The 5,525-mile U.S.-Canada border is undefended, and nearly 330,000 people and $2 billion worth of goods cross it every day. 800,000 Canadians live in the United States. Trump's approach to dealing with Canada marks an extraordinary departure from the traditionally cooperative relationship between the two countries. Trump has imposed tariffs on Canadian goods in a push to bring manufacturing back to the United States and make inflammatory comments about turning Canada into America's 51st state. Carney said Canada had recognized that America has changed and that the two countries would not return to our old relationship. The Canadian public is fed up. A petition to expel U.S. Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, a Trump ally, has collected nearly 248,000 signatures since July 21st. It accuses the former Republican congressman from Michigan of having normalized Trump's talks of annexing Canada, among other things. The two countries had good reasons to find a compromise. Nearly 72% of Canada's goods exports last year went to the United States. The Trump administration might be wary of imposing new tariffs paid by U.S. importers who try to pass alongside the cost to consumers via higher prices. Before the November midterm elections, American voters are already frustrated with the high cost of living. Both sides will be under immense pressure in the coming days to still find an off-ramp, said Ryan Mezuris, a partner at King & Spalding and a former U.S. trade official. Joshua Bolton, CEO of Business Roundtable, which represents leaders of major U.S. companies, warned the tariffs and retaliation risk raising costs for American businesses and families and disrupting vital supply chains, and urged both governments to resume negotiations. Trump has turned to Depression-era trade penalties. Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his second-term economic agenda. Last year, he imposed double-digit import taxes on almost every country, justifying them by declaring the long-standing U.S. trade deficit a national emergency. The Supreme Court in February ruled that he had overstepped his authority. The justices struck down the trade penalties and set the stage for the federal government to pay refunds to importers. So he has to look for other legal authority to justify tariffs. After the Supreme Court struck down much of Trump's earlier tariff program, the administration turned to other legal authorities. For Canada, Trump invoked Section 338 of the Tariff Act of 1930, a rarely used Depression-era provision allowing tariffs of up to 50% against countries deemed to discriminate against U.S. businesses. The provision is part of the Smoot-Hawley tariff law, widely blamed by economists and historians for worsening the Great Depression by restricting global trade. Section 338 has never been used to impose tariffs. The rift comes as the United States, Mexico, and Canada are trying to renew a trade agreement that Trump negotiated in his first term and once praised as a triumph. The United States has begun formal talks with Mexico over revamping the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, known as USMCA, but talks with Canada have not begun. Next up, Florida demonstrates how to adapt coastal cities for climate change. By Dorani Pineda at Associated Press. One day there was a roof. The next morning it was gone. Jeffrey Hoover still remembers the day some 34 years ago when Hurricane Andrew blew off the roof of his childhood home, one of tens of thousands damaged and destroyed across southern Florida. For days, first responders couldn't get to them. For a month and a half, they relied on food donations. For more than a year, he lived with his family in a trailer. It wasn't just about the storm itself, but it was about the aftermath of that storm and how we begin to design for those aspects, said Huber, a landscape architect and professor who was 12 in 1992 when the Category 5 hurricane hit. We are seeing extreme storms, extreme scenarios like this that are becoming much more common. Some 129 million people, nearly 40% of the U.S. population, live in coastal counties. Recent research shows that a rise in sea level driven by humans has increased the frequency of extreme coastal flooding around the world. As climate change threatens communities, Florida is showing how to build to adapt throughout the state. Architects and designers are merging infrastructure with urban design to create residential buildings, parks, and more. The goal is to better withstand rising waters, worsening storms, saltwater intrusion, heat waves, and other climate impacts. In places like Miami, we're dealing with a combination of tidal flooding, storm surge, and long-term sea level rise, said Huber, professor in the School of Architecture at Florida Atlantic University. So the question isn't about how we stop water, but it's how we live on with and over it. As global average temperatures climb because of fossil fuel emissions, so do sea levels, making low-lying coastal cities vulnerable to flooding. Frequent flooding and intensifying storm surges got so bad in Miami Beach that when it rained, Anya Freeman rushed home to move her car because her street filled with knee-deep water, and she couldn't get car insurance for flooding. But nobody was doing anything practical about it, she said. So in 2024, she left behind her career as a lawyer to launch Kind Designs, a startup creating 3D-printed living seawalls to protect shorelines from flooding. These seawalls are meant to be affordable so that they can be scaled and also serve as marine habitat. They made faster and with a non-toxic concrete mixture that can be custom-shaped for the ecosystems where they're installed. On a recent August day, workers in neon green shirts and yellow construction hats installed one mimicking mangroves at a waterfront church in Fort Lauderdale, north of Miami. Traditional seawalls are flat, but theirs can be designed to mimic natural coastal features, like the mangrove roots you'd find in Miami or barnacle clusters in New York. We have a whole library of designs for different marine habitats, and the point is to attract the native species, create caves where they can hide from predators, and also to dissipate waves, she said. Their technology dissipates at least 45% of wave energy, making it more resilient to overtopping and erosion. On one wall, researchers from Florida International University identified 51 species living in it 1 year after installation, including filter feeders like oysters and tube worms that clean water. The Vista Breeze affordable senior housing project in Miami Beach by the architectural firm, Brooks Scarpish Huber, is a real-world application of how to live with the threats of water. The 119-unit, two-building complex is elevated 10 feet from sea level and is designed to withstand storm surges of up to 20 feet. Concrete is mixed with crystalline, waterproof powder that blocks water from penetrating into it, protecting structures and extending their life. Rebar coated in zinc shields it from rust and corrosion. From a heat mitigation standpoint, the buildings are oriented southeast to the prevailing breezes, passively cooling themselves. There are also community rooms, courtyards, and terraces to promote socializing. The elevators are hidden, and the stairs made prominent to encourage their use. About 30 miles north, a former parking lot was transformed into a public space that doubles as flood infrastructure. DC Alexander Park in Fort Lauderdale has a 25-foot artistic overlook that provides shade on hot days. Financing, policy, and community support are just some of the challenges architects and urban planners face with implementation. About a decade ago, architectural designer, urban planner, and Future Vision Studios founder Aaron DeMaio began developing the Coastline, a regional resilience master plan proposal to protect southern Florida from storm surge and sea level rise. Finding it will have a large price tag, but the need and the urgency, I think, merits this type of infrastructure solution, he said. We have a massive amount of low-lying property and property that could be impacted from storm surge, he said. And what we're presenting here is going to have a very large return on investment because we're protecting hundreds of miles of direct waterfront property, as well as property behind that waterfront property. At the University of Miami Center for Urban and Community Design, founder after the 1992 hurricane that damaged Huber's home, designer, architect, and the center's director, Thomas Klein, is working to address a problem, a lack of assistance to help lower-income communities afford climate-resilient projects. For Klein, funding scarcity for climate-resilient infrastructure is an opportunity to build in a way that provides multiple services. In 2026, is it acceptable to just build a road to move cars Or does the road need to also move bicyclists and have a bus rapid transit line, but also manage stormwater and ameliorate for heat island issues, he said. This fall, they're also launching an initiative to conceptualize and design sponge parks in South Florida that use green and other infrastructure to absorb rain and manage stormwater. And that looks like all the time that we have for today. Thank you for listening in and enjoy the rest of your weekend.